easy, like whittling a stick. Go to your local library and pull out books on religions, mythology, philosophy, and psychology that pique your interest. Open your chest wide. Put your hand in the middle where your ribs join. Some spiritual traditions call this the heart center. Open it up to new thoughts. When you do something from your soul, you feel a river moving in you, a joy. Rumi. What's your spiritual fast pass? Disney has a fast pass ticketing system in their theme parks, offering a shortcut to the front of the queue. Keep an eye out for things that can do the same in your spiritual life, allowing you faster access to deeper spiritual waters. A mantra, for example, or a crystal, an image, a statue, mala beads, a bangle, or even the physical space where you regularly meditate or worship. One friend has a tattoo inside her wrist that helps her focus. Some people who are highly attuned can feel the patina of devotion when they enter certain places of worship, such as a temple or church. Walking a labyrinth has the same effect. I recently tried this for the first time here in Sydney, in the company of about a dozen women, none of whom I had met before, under the gentle guidance of American spiritualist Judith Tripp. It was a sort of gentle walking meditation. We started sitting down and meditated for a short time, before standing up in a circle and holding hands. Judith asked us to think about our families, our ancestors, and other women in the world all standing behind us, supporting us. She told us to think of our feet as roots connecting us to nature and the center of the earth, and imagine the branches of trees putting their arms about us, embracing us. At this point, some of you will be Googling, "Where's the nearest labyrinth?" and others will have flung this book across the room. Labyrinth walking may not be for everyone, but the point is to try new things. Trail your fingers through the water. As Marianne Williamson beautifully put it, wisdom is like a marinade. First you take what a book said, or what a teacher said, and then you mix it with your own ideas. Then you add experiences and pour in a few buckets of tears. Add memories of lost love, a pinch of personal humiliation, and a teaspoon of deep regrets. Add to that a cup of courage. Leave it to soak for a few years, and voila, darn it if you have not become wise. Spending time in nature is another spiritual fast pass for me, and I can see why the Japanese forest bathing, or shinrin-yoku, basically being in the presence of trees, has been proven to lower heart rate and blood pressure, reduce stress hormone production, boost the immune system, and improve overall feelings of well-being. There can be no very black melancholy to him who lives in the midst of nature and has his senses still. I have never felt lonesome or in the least oppressed by a sense of solitude. Henry David Thoreau. Here are a few quick ways to connect with nature. Lie on your back and watch the stars. Put your bare feet on grass. Savor the weather. Walk in the rain and get your face wet. Enjoy the changing seasons. Watch out for birds. Bring nature into your home. Rather than flowers, put branches in a big vase, a collection of driftwood, or some abandoned nests and feathers. Listen to the sea breathe, or just a recording of it. Choose a bird or animal you identify with as your spirit guide for a day. Get some lovely old books of animal prints from a second-hand shop as inspiration. Find some art that repays contemplation. Some of my favorites are Monet's water lilies from the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris, Rothko's Seagram paintings, Anthony Gormley's haunting installation Another Place and his Angel of the North, Elizabeth Frink's sculptures. Oh, the list goes on. Alternatively, find your patron saint, or even align yourself to an ancient goddess to help access your spiritual self. When I set out to write this book, I hoped to find the patron saint of people living alone. After all, belt makers, comedians, Italian prison officers, and even STDs have patron saints. St. Alexius, St. Genesius, St. Basilides, and St. Fiacre, respectively. So why not us? Sadly, I was disappointed. Maybe we can appropriate one. Wikipedia has a list of patron saints handily indexed by occupation and activity. To find a patron ancient goddess whose characteristics are in line with yours, go to goddessmecca.com or Google Find Goddess Archetype and do the quiz. I was most like the goddess Hecate, and I felt the feedback was pretty accurate for me. If this is your archetype, you are capable of living in the present and trusting the universe. Career choices could span the arts, telecommunications, motivational speaker, or life coach. You know the world's illusionary, and you value spiritual connection. Oprah Winfrey is a perfect example of this archetype. This is a powerful archetype for the woman who is capable of aging in an interesting and healthy manner. If this is your archetype, you have the gift of seeing life as a series of lessons and have probably developed a great sense of humor. Life is viewed as a rich tapestry, beautiful despite its inherent flaws. Why not give it a crack to add a different perspective? Charlatans and crackpots. In case you are now thinking I have completely lost the plot, I'm not purporting that ancient goddesses are the answer. Another bead on our spiritual necklaces. For the record, I have seen tarot and oracle card readers, made multiple visits to a psychic, seen someone who says they can converse with the dead, and I own a beautiful set of Lenormand tarot cards. Am I 100% convinced of their usefulness, accuracy, and insight? No. Do I think they're a complete waste of time and money, utter bullshit, and the provenance of hustlers? No. The jury's out. For me, the truth lies somewhere in between. What I can report is that each time I have seen one of these people, I had a specific issue in mind, and by the end of the session, it was resolved in some way. I accept this might be my post-rationalizing to justify the visit, but if it made me feel better, then it's a success as far as I'm concerned. Some friends have found that oracle cards in particular can be helpful when making a decision or setting the course for the day. For the investment of a few dollars, why not try them out? I bought a pack of Goddess Inspiration Oracle cards by Chris Wilder, but Doreen Virtue is the best-known queen of the oracle cards, focusing primarily on angels. Of course, we are responsible for our own futures, and we can't subcontract that job to oracle cards and psychics. But if they help give us clarity of thought or a nudge in the right direction, in my mind, that's a good thing. Bullshit-free meditation and mindfulness. Buddhists say that we can learn everything we need to know about the world by sitting on a cushion. But that's easier said than done. The writers of an experiment in Science magazine in 2014 found that participants typically did not enjoy spending even 6 to 15 minutes in a room alone with nothing to do but think. They enjoyed doing mundane activities, and many preferred to administer electric shocks to themselves rather than being left alone with their thoughts. The paper concludes, most people seem to prefer to be doing something rather than nothing, even if that something is negative. I find that incredible, but I also understand that the benefits of sitting quietly and doing nothing take a while to reveal themselves. I have finally learned that if you lie in a river of stillness, the eddies and currents will actually take you places. It is the adventure of going nowhere. I needed no encouragement to try meditation, and there are many scientific studies that prove its value. However, I am still meditating on L-plates, and I have to keep telling myself that the more I do it, the easier and more beneficial it will become. Just 10 minutes at the same time every day, Jane. How hard can that be? We set ourselves such a high expectation of what meditation can deliver that it is almost off-putting, especially if we don't experience remarkable change immediately. If you are starting out, think of meditation as just the practice of being alone and being comfortable with it. Less of the to-do and more of the to be. Elizabeth Lesser writes that meditation is used to pierce the veil between our ordinary consciousness and the angelic realms. I have yet to achieve any moments of bliss or reach those elusive angelic realms myself. However, even if meditation is just your mind's way of deleting the trash, like you do on a computer, then it's worth it. The author Ken Robinson describes it as a powerful way of reconnecting with yourself and brightening your sense of who you are beneath the surface. And yes, it's not called a meditation practice for nothing. Practice makes permanent. Having a teacher will keep you on track, but you can learn how to meditate on your own. There are many different disciplines, but the basic principles are similar, with a focus on the breath and letting thoughts come and then float away. It's not about knocking thoughts on the head, but about calming the busy, so-called monkey mind. A misnomer, as it turns out monkeys are very focused. I have found the app Headspace to be the most helpful in getting me started and keeping me on track. The English narrator, Andy, walks you through the practice in a clear and straightforward way. It is an excellent place both to start and continue your meditation journey. Our life is an endless journey. It is like a broad highway that extends infinitely into the distance. The practice of meditation provides a vehicle to travel on that road. Our journey consists of constant ups and downs, hope and fear, but it is a good journey. The practice of meditation allows us to experience all the textures of the roadway, which is what the journey is all about. Chogyam Trungpa. Sometimes, for variety, I practice Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk Chich Nhat Hanh's Four Pebbles meditation. It was originally designed for children, so it's nice and simple. Find four smooth pebbles or polished stones from a crystal shop that appeal to you and assign each one a role and quality. The first one is a flower to represent freshness, the second a mountain for solidity, the third still water for calm and tranquility, and the last stone is space for freedom. These four aspects, freshness, solidity, calm, and freedom, form the basis of the meditation. We can develop our minds infinitely. There is no limitation. Many of us are discontent with how many possessions we have, but we're content when it comes to our spiritual development. That is the first mistake we make. Tenzin Gyatso, 14th Dalai Lama. Once you have settled, hold each stone in your hands one by one and focus on the quality it represents. As you breathe in and out, think of the image and the quality. The first pebble, breathing in, I feel fresh, and out, I am a flower. The second pebble, breathing in, I am solid, and out, I am a mountain. The third pebble, breathing in, water, stillness, and out, reflecting. The fourth pebble, breathing in, I feel space inside me and around. And out, I am free. There is, of course, a YouTube video to guide you, Pebble Pocket Meditation. I keep my stones in a little bag on my mini altar with a card to remind me which stone is which. I still find it hard to get my head around mindfulness, meditation's slightly try-hard younger brother. Mindfulness has been described as non-judgmental awareness of the moment we are in, pausing the commentary in our heads. Ching Nhat Hanh teaches that this moment is the only one we have complete control over, so is therefore the most important thing in our life. We need to stop always thinking that there's something better around the corner and just enjoy what we're doing right now. For me, the most practical way of incorporating mindfulness into my life is to press the pause button for a moment. Savor and appreciate some of the mundane things I do, as if it were for the first or the last time, even if that's just eating an apple. Watch a very good interview between Oprah and Chich Nhat Hanh on the subject of mindfulness online. Define your version of spirituality. One is not born a woman, one becomes one, said Simone de Beauvoir. Living alone and embracing our spiritual side concentrates the process of growth. It is an important part of our maturing as human beings and sentient souls. How, or if, you choose to formally define your version of spirituality is up to you. I find it helpful to think of it like a necklace, composed of a bead here, e.g. meditation, and a bead there, e.g. labyrinth. Mine is still in its early days, although I think it is making progress when I find myself being more patient and forgiving, meditating when standing in a queue, or appreciating the impact of nature. It's a good feeling, and it seems to be gaining traction. Oprah coined it well when she mused that it isn't until you come to a spiritual understanding of who you are, which might not be a religious feeling, but the spirit deep within you, that you finally begin to take control. How? How do you incorporate spirituality into your daily life? I think it often manifests itself as attitude, an attitude that defines how you approach life and the different situations you encounter. It informs everything you do. It is your guardrail. Hopefully you will feel happier and more peaceful because you have what you need to be fulfilled inside yourself, or at least know where to look for inspiration and guidance. You don't need anyone else. Pay attention to and cultivate your inner life. Become a scholar of self and soul. Expose yourself to different aspects of spirituality and religion, and then succumb to your intuition. Get the being right, and the living will follow. When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That is my religion, said Abraham Lincoln. If we act the same way over and over again, it eventually becomes the way we are. I try to shy away from frenemies who pull me down and avoid materialism, rudeness, busyness, and gossip. I aim to direct myself towards curiosity, open-mindedness, and finding the best in other people and in myself. You can live your life in the shallow end or in the deep end. It's easier to make splashes in the shallow end. The deep is much more rewarding, but it does take more work. It is a good idea to have some sort of physical reminder of spirituality in your home. It could be a quiet place to sit, a special picture, or a collection of objects. I have an eclectic grouping of religious items on a desk in my bedroom. Small wooden gilded Italian triptychs and diptychs featuring Catholic saints rub shoulders with a carved wooden Buddha with beads round his neck and a small brass Hindu Shingshan throne with a tiny Ganesh on it. I love the look of this beautiful and calming tableau, and for some reason I feel it offers me protection. The whole subject of spirituality is an incredibly personal one and well suited to us soloists. Elizabeth Cady Stanton captured it well. Our inner being, which we call ourself, no eye nor touch of man or angel has ever pierced. If you are feeling a bit lost or overwhelmed, give yourself a day's sabbatical. Take time to rest and think and listen to your inner self. Most of the answers to the questions we have already lie within us. Your wings may feel a little broken and ruffled, but wrap them lovingly around yourself and relax. Once you have found some sort of inner equilibrium, you might discover that synchronicity starts making its presence felt. That is a marvelous feeling, and much more than mere coincidence. It could be that the person you have been thinking about calls you out of the blue, or a book you've been looking for is on top of the pile in the second-hand bookshop, or you meet someone who is an expert in a subject you have just become interested in. When I am shut down spiritually, synchronicity dries up. When I am open, confident, and optimistic, even if I'm role-playing to get there, it starts happening. In On My Own, Florence Falk writes of self-blessing as a final stage before stepping out. I think that is a lovely idea, a bit of positive acknowledgement that you are on your own spiritual path, your private Camino way. Grief and death. I think it is important to touch on the subject of death in this book. Living alone is not about flinching. I will approach this topic in two ways. The first is the experience of grief when someone close to you dies, and the second is the contemplation of our own death. Grief. I still can't truly believe my parents are dead. That happens to other people, not to the two people I loved best in the world, who knew me inside out, whose hands and turns of phrase I knew, who I could be completely relaxed with. Parents' deaths mark the true beginning of adulthood, when we realize we are the next cab off the rank. But the death of anyone close to us, or even a celebrity, rattles us. Everyone feels and expresses their grief in their own way, and that is how it should be. A part of me rather admires the sang-froid of the English, epitomized by the royal family at Diana's funeral, and I loathe the mawkish crosses, teddy bears and plastic flowers attached to trees and telegraph poles as memorials for accidents. But there is another primal part of me that, when my parents died, wanted to behave like Boadicea, queen of the Iceni, cover myself in woad and scream and scream. Part of that screaming is because we look back and miss them, and part is in reminder of our own tentative grip on life as we look forward. It is a tap on the shoulder. The passage below captures the feelings of grief beautifully, and I don't think I can better it. I came across it online and can't find the name of the writer, but I reproduce it here with my acknowledgement and thanks. It appeared in response to someone who simply wrote, "My friend just died. I don't know what to do." This was the reply. All right, here goes. I'm old. What that means is that I've survived, so far, and a lot of people I've known and loved did not. I've lost friends, best friends, acquaintances, co-workers, grandparents, mum, relatives, teachers, mentors, students, neighbours, and a host of other folks. I have no children, and I can't imagine the pain it must be to lose a child. But here's my two cents. I wish I could say you get used to people dying. I never did. I don't want to. It tears a hole through me whenever somebody I love dies, no matter the circumstances. But I don't want it to not matter. I don't want it to be something that just passes. My scars are a testament to the love and the relationship I had for and with that person. And if the scar is deep, so was the love. So be it. Scars are a testament to life. Scars are a testament that I can love deeply and live deeply and be cut or even gouged, and that I can heal and continue to live and continue to love. And the scar tissue is stronger than the original flesh ever was. Scars are a testament to life. Scars are only ugly to people who can't see. As for grief, you'll find it comes in waves. When the ship is first wrecked, you're drowning, with wreckage all around. Everything floating around you reminds you of the beauty and magnificence of the ship that was and is no more. And all you can do is float. You find some piece of the wreckage, and you hang on for a while. Maybe it's some physical thing. Maybe a happy memory or a photograph. Or a person who is also floating. For a while, all you can do is float. Stay alive. In the beginning, the waves are 100 feet tall and crash over you without mercy. They come 10 seconds apart and don't give you time to catch your breath. All you can do is hang on and float. After a while, maybe weeks, maybe months, the waves are still 100 feet tall, but come further apart. When they come, they still crash all over you and wipe you out. But between, you can breathe, you can function. You never know what's going to trigger the grief. It might be a song, a picture, a street intersection, the smell of a cup of coffee. It could be anything. And the wave comes crashing. But between waves, there is life. Somewhere down the line, and it's different for everybody, you'll find that the waves are only 80 feet tall, or 50 feet tall. And while they still come, they come further apart. You can see them coming. An anniversary, a birthday, or Christmas, or landing at O'Hare. You can see it coming, for the most part, and prepare yourself. And when it washes over you, you know that somehow you will, again, come out the other side. Soaking wet, spluttering, still hanging on to some tiny piece of the wreckage, but you'll come out. Take it from an old guy. The waves never stop coming, and somehow you don't really want them to, but you learn that you'll survive them. And other waves will come, and you'll survive them too. If you're lucky, you'll have lots of scars from lots of loves and lots of shipwrecks. It's so curious. One can resist tears and behave very well in the hardest hours of grief. But then someone makes you a friendly sign behind the window, or one notices that a flower that was in bud only yesterday has suddenly blossomed, or a letter slips from a drawer, and everything collapses. Colette. Many people who have lost someone find comfort in the book Healing After Loss, Daily Meditations for Working Through Grief by Martha Whitmore Hickman. Another beautiful book is Our Souls at Night by Kent Harouf, about two aging people addressing loneliness after their spouses' deaths. It is incredibly moving and even more poignant when you learn that the author was dying as he wrote it. You cannot stare straight into the face of the sun or death. François de la Rochefoucauld. Death and what it can teach us. In Staring at the Sun, Irvin D. Yalom explores the subject of anxiety about death and how to lessen its impact. I cannot do the whole book justice here, but will outline some of the nuggets. He talks about awakening experiences, which could be as dramatic as a lucky escape from death, or as confrontational as being diagnosed with a life-threatening or life-ending disease, or more subtle everyday confrontations, such as a birthday with a zero on the end, grief, divorce, children moving out, or when a dream doesn't work. These awakening experiences are an abruption that can have a positive transformative impact. Many medieval monks kept a skull in their cells to focus their minds on their mortality and therefore on how they should live their lives. Knowing that we are destined to die can motivate us to focus more on our everyday life. St. Augustine said, "It is only in the face of death that a man's self is born." The fear of death follows from the fear of life. A man who lives fully is prepared to die at any time. Author unknown. I remember reading that you die twice, once when you die and once when you are forgotten. Yalom describes rippling as a way to ensure this doesn't happen. Rippling refers to the fact that each of us creates, often without our conscious intent or knowledge, concentric circles of influence that may affect others for years, even for generations. It's not necessarily about our name or anything physical. We learned that lesson from Shelley's beautiful poem Ozymandias, about an immense statue of the King of Kings that now lies broken and abandoned in a wasteland. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. It can be small. It could be the impact you have on someone. Look for her among your friends, was the advice given to a daughter whose mother had died. Have a think about what ripples you might have created or will create. What would you like your legacy to be? As well as taking comfort from the rippling effect of good deeds, other advice from Yalom includes spending our lives doing what we love so that we will not look back with regret, reaching out to form meaningful interpersonal relationships, and being bold in making necessary lifestyle changes that can bring us greater contentment. Live in the moment, he urges, and make each day count. This seems like obvious advice, but like the dieting and the meditation, it only works when you actually do it. Yalom also advises us to keep in mind the advantage of remaining aware of death, of hugging its shadow to you. Such awareness can integrate the darkness with your spark of life and enhance your life while you still have it. The day which we fear is our last is but the birthday of eternity. Seneca. It may be time I tackle the novel The Death of Ivan Ilyich by Leo Tolstoy, about a man who is about to die and realizes he has not fully lived. Some books come into our lives at certain times for a reason, and I hear this book knocking at my door. Life After Death. I heard the sublime singer Deva Premal. Her album of mantras, The Essence, is one of my absolute favourites. And her unlikely partner, the grizzled Cockney Mitten, calmly talking about a dying person leaving their body. No fear, just moving on to the next stage. That was an I'll have what she's having moment for me. I need to learn more about it. I am at the base camp of Everest on this subject, but I don't want this life to be the end. I want to believe that there is something more and that one day I'll be reunited with my loved ones. If you don't feel the same and believe that when you die it's all over, that's fine too. With no partner to bounce these important issues off, it is important we ponder them alone so that we prepare ourselves mentally for reaching that stage of our lives. Death, the practicalities. Burial or cremation, church or under a tree, religious or humanist. Adele's When We Were Young, Robbie Williams' Angels, or God forbid, Wind Beneath My Wings. Boring wooden box or a fab personalized coffin. Go immediately to lifeart.com.au to see the possibilities. Melancholy wake or champagne party before you go. Friends as pallbearers, ashes scattered or buried next to the family. And what would you like on your headstone? These questions could be the basis for a fun party game, were they not so important. And your relatives or friends will be so relieved if you have answered them in advance. It's to get the send-off that you want, the way you lived. So write it down and make sure someone knows where it is. As a well-spent day brings happy sleep, so a life well-used brings happy death. Leonardo da Vinci. Takeaways. Spirituality gives you an internal reservoir of courage and wisdom. It feeds your energy and the way you project yourself to the world. Learn to appreciate the benefits of solitude and silence. Listen to your intuition. Identify your spiritual fast pass, from walking a labyrinth, nature, a mantra, or finding a patron saint or goddess. Find a way into meditation that suits you. Define your own spiritual necklace and the beads that go on it. Give yourself the time to relax and maintain equilibrium and then watch synchronicity happen. Think about the waves of grief and the scars of love and your shipwrecks. Reduce the fear of death so that it scares you less and inspires you more. Chapter 10, Taking Action. How to get stuff done, time, action boards, notebooks, accountability. The world belongs to those who do. I hope this book encourages and inspires you to live the life you love alone. I hope it has sown seeds. But there is no point in having thoughts, plans, and dreams unless you splice them into your life. Don't live with a pile of shoulda, coulda, woulda, if only I had the time. You have more time than you think. We spend on average over 46 days a year on the internet and 41 days watching TV, as opposed to 4.4 days reading. The tools we are given to work with are thoughts, words, and actions, but the first two are redundant without the third. Action, any action, will lift a burden from your shoulders and propel you swiftly forwards. Ban the words, I don't have time, and replace them with, I will find the time. Following are some suggestions to help push you off the diving board. Be a postage stamp. Stick to one thing until you get there. If you spread yourself too widely, you risk spreading yourself too thinly. It's better to take aim at one thing and get it done. Multitasking is a lie. Willpower is readily available, but it's a finite resource, so use it early and wisely, and it will serve you. These are some of the key principles of The One Thing by Gary Keller and Jay Passapan, who believe that extraordinary results are determined by how narrowly you focus. Think of the one thing you can do that will make an appreciable difference in each of the key areas of your life. Living alone happily, relationships, health, finances, spirituality, and so on. Chunks of time. Chunking down is a business term used to describe the process of moving from broad, abstract ideas to smaller, more specific and manageable chunks. Activity is not the same as productivity, and chunking down time is a good way of not letting it slip through your fingers. I don't want to be that annoying person who says, "Where has the time gone?" And at least if I have assigned my time, I'm one step ahead. When you take control of your time, you take control of your life. The process of dividing up time comes with a pedigree. It is an ancient practice, well documented in Sarah Maitland's Book of Silence. She talks about how people over the centuries lived in silence and how they navigated it. Drawing up rules of life, schedules or timetables, and then exercising one's will to stick to them seems to be a necessary defense against the sluggish torpor of acidy and its attendant dangers. Acidy means listlessness or apathy. Whether I am at home or at work, I split the day into hours like a timetable. It makes me more efficient and helps me squeeze the juice out of every day. So I can spend 2 hours writing, an hour going for a walk or to the gym, an hour doing emails, an hour clearing the decks, and so on. You will know if you concentrate better in the evening or the morning, owl or fowl, and can schedule tasks accordingly. I am lucky in that time always flies for me, and I always have things to do. If you don't, and time is a burden, split your day into blocks and assign each one a purpose. For some people, shorter time spans work better. Author Francesco Cirillo swears by 25-minute Pomodoros of concentrated effort, interspersed with short breaks. The Pomodoro technique is named after the tomato-shaped kitchen timer he uses. Small steps count. I keep reminding myself of this to make challenges less daunting. Taking the first steps along a path brings contentment and hope. It's interesting how action begets action and you quickly gain momentum. Every day. They say the way you spend your days is the way you spend your life, so make sure they count. Each day I complete between 1 and 3 things. That's not to say I don't get a lot more done in a day. I do. But this isn't just about finishing a work project or the ironing. It's about doing just one thing that notches me towards achieving my bigger goals. Some people call these MITs, or most important tasks. I try to do them as early in the day as possible, when my willpower is on full charge. A good litmus test of how well I'm doing is to ask myself, did today matter? Every week. I set myself between 1 and 3 small goals weekly, and these tend to be quite specific. It could be walking at least 10,000 steps every day, finishing my tax return, and sending 10 emails to friends. I write these goals on post-it notes stuck in the kitchen and bathroom. This is one of the joys of living alone. You can bear your post-it note soul in private. An alternative is to focus on a theme a week for several weeks. It could be health, relationships, finances, work, home, or spirituality. Alternatively, in her book 5-2 Your Life, Kate Harrison offers a 6-week plan with each week dedicated to one of the following: discover, connect, simplify, move, relax, and do. Every month. At the beginning of the month, I assign myself either a theme or a deadline for one thing I want to finish. Writing this book, clearing the house of clutter, finalizing a work project, or connecting with old friends. Every year. Every year, I set myself just one big achievement. There are 2 ways to approach this one major thing. Either challenge yourself to learn a new skill, It could be a new language or a new sport or hobby. Look up classes right now. Or finally, truthfully, nail some goals that have been kicking around for a while, like losing a specific amount of weight, working to make your home exactly the way you want it, organizing your finances and saving up a certain amount of money, or getting a certain relationship back on track. This doesn't have to be a January the first thing. A new year starts on any day of the next 365 days. Mondays can be powerful enough. Just make sure that you can look yourself in the mirror on day 365 and say, nailed it. Breathing space. Our lives are full, but little jolts of happiness can happen in the breathing spaces between the main events, if we are open to that. The sun shining on your face, a bird flying across the sky that only you can see, the touch of a friend's hand on your shoulder, an unexpected uplifting email from a friend. As children, we played at avoiding the cracks in the pavement because the bears might get us. Now I think the cracks are where the real beauty lies. Bring on the bears. What would Oprah do? If you are feeling lethargic, out of sorts, or unmotivated, slip into someone else's skin. How would the best you, your alter ego, and or someone you respect approach this situation? Or pretend you're being filmed for your own reality show. How do you want to be perceived? I find this quick mind shift a great catalyst. Curate an action board. I don't believe you make a vision board and wallop, it manifests. However, I do enjoy both the process and the end result of making my ambitions visually concrete. More action board than vision board. My board captures the joys of living alone and the plans and dreams I have. It makes me feel good as soon as I look at it. Throughout this book, you might have liked some ideas and rejected others, like a hen pecking at grain, instinctively picking and choosing what will work best for you and your self-keeping plan for the future. Capture some of them on your board. Pick images and ephemera carefully with the eyes of a curator. The word curate comes from the Latin cura, or care, meaning to carefully select and edit the items you want and place them together to give them greater meaning. Every image has to earn its keep. Curation is a word very much in vogue and overused in the context of the internet, and is traditionally used in connection with museums and art galleries, with the curator choosing which works are selected and how they are displayed. It is a rare talent that your gut recognizes when it is done truly well. The best and wittiest example of curation I have ever seen is at the Hunting Museum in Paris, Musée de la Chasse et de la Nature. You can use Pinterest to make a virtual pin board, although I prefer a physical board, but either way you can display the finished version as wallpaper on your computer screen or phone. I have experimented with different methods of making boards and think I've finally nailed it. Buy a sheet of 90 by 60 centimeter foam core board at an office supply shop, cutting it smaller if you prefer. I like to cover mine with fabric, so I use the board that has an adhesive side. Simply stick your fabric on, buy some long pins and you're good to go. Foam core is very light, so it is easy to pin and repin images. Nothing is stuck down permanently, which is how it should be, as your board will change. Look online and in magazines, and in this book, for quotations and images that resonate and inspire, and look in junk and antique shops for ephemera and other bits and bobs. I scour the internet to buy things with the number one on them. Old tin numbers from petrol stations, a one from a cricket scoreboard, and an old price tag. I am a one! I have also taken photographs of moments that epitomize my solo life. Watching the dawn sky from my bedroom window, sitting by my little fire pit with a glass of wine and roasting marshmallows in winter, my newly made crispy white bed, all as solitary pleasures, capturing a solo life well led, along with my plans for the future. You can add tickets, postcards, and trinkets, tchotchkes, as my American Jewish friend would call them, to bring it to life. There are no rules, it is just for you. Sometimes I make smaller boards if I want to address a specific issue in more detail. It is also interesting to reflect on the board after time has passed. What has changed? what still works and what is no longer relevant. You instinctively make course corrections, just like moving the steering wheel slightly when you're driving along a straight road. It is a nudge in the direction of action. You must live in the present, launch yourself on every wave, find your eternity in each moment. Fools stand on their island opportunities and look toward another land. There is no other land, there is no other life but this. Henry David Thoreau. The notebook system. I find it helpful to have several notebooks on the go. You probably have a system that works best for you. This is mine. I have an A4 hardcover journal, a lovely ribbon-tied marble paper-covered book that I bought in Italy, for my eyes only. Do you remember at school when we used scrap paper for workings out? My journal is where I do my own personal workings out. I write how I feel, motivate myself, and collect inspirational ideas I have heard or seen. It helps shape me and is where I talk things through with myself. However, I feel under no obligation to write something every day. I use four other books too. A spiral-bound counter book, long and thin for my ongoing to-do list, with pages dedicated to work, writing, the house, and so on. An A5 moleskin notebook in my handbag, with a pen stuffed in the spine for writing down recommendations, things I see, or even phrases I hear on the radio. Each one fills up in about a month. Then I go through them and copy down the keepers into another book. A tiny spiral-bound pad for shopping lists, etc. A post-it notepad for my 3-point do-today prompt. I prefer physical notebooks, but digitally-minded mates swear by Evernote, which is a cross-platform app that serves many purposes, as a journal, a note-taking tool, digital filing cabinet, recipe keeper, and many more. Develop rituals. Aristotle said, "We are what we repeatedly do," so it makes sense to do those things we repeatedly do well, and that's where rituals come in. Since I have lived alone, I have unconsciously established routines and rituals. I like the rhythm, pulse, and punctuation they give my life. What's the difference between a ritual and a routine? Good question, young grasshopper. Both are repeated actions, but a ritual is done with purpose and intent, with a bit of reverence and ceremony thrown in. A ritual is deliberate, whereas a routine is unthinking. A ritual can become a routine, but rarely the other way round. Still with me? Ritual and routine seem to be two sides of the same coin. While routine aims to make the chaos of everyday life more containable and controllable, ritual aims to imbue the mundane with an element of the magical. Maria Popova at brainpickings.org. The easiest way to introduce simple rituals into your life is to develop a morning routine that helps set the framework for the day. Here are a few ideas. The first thing you see and do each morning are important. My bedside table always has fresh flowers and a photograph of my children. My action board is on my desk and in full sight. Before I put my feet down, I think about what sort of a day I'm going to have and capture it in one positive adjective. Open the curtains as soon as you wake up and have a beautiful glass of water with lemon juice by your bed to sip first thing. If you've had a strong dream, quickly write it down. Meditate for 10 minutes, maybe striking a Tibetan singing bowl to get you started. Many people enjoy Qigong exercises after waking to give a boost of energy. Try the 10-minute morning Qi ritual by Lee Holden on YouTube, or just stretch. I set out my go-to weekday breakfast, berries, yogurt and oats, in the fridge the night before. I do 20 quick things to get the house ready for the day, emptying the dishwasher, sorting laundry, putting papers away, taking out the rubbish, feeding the dog, etc. I'm clearing the decks before the start of a performance, priming my day. Some people like affirmations, some don't. If you do, find a book of daily affirmations that suits you. Try Interactions, Visions to Bring Your Inner and Outer World into Harmony by Stephen C. Paul and Gary Max Collins. Or just pick an oracle card. See chapter 9. Other people swear by writing morning pages, another idea from The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, which are three pages of longhand stream of consciousness, chronicling anything that comes into your mind. Julia Cameron describes them as using a dustbuster on your mind. This is a clearing exercise. If you get all your negative stuff down on paper, it doesn't then interfere with your day and makes room for more profound thoughts. The landmines that sabotage my morning ritual are drinking too much the night before, sleeping in, eating a big breakfast, looking at emails or social media first thing, or watching breakfast TV, so I never, ever do them. Every day a thread makes a skein in the year. Dutch proverb. Productivity is about doing things you've never been able to do before. Franz Kafka. Another lovely ritual I've started to embrace at the other end of the day is the 15-minute violet hour. This marks the end of the working day and the beginning of the evening at about 6 o'clock, and is a time to lower emotional and mental defenses and relax. Bernard DeVoto coined the phrase in The Hour. This is the violet hour, the hour of hush and wonder, when the affections glow and valor is reborn, when the shadows deepen along the edge of the forest, and we believe that, if we watch carefully, at any moment we may see the unicorn. The violet hour doesn't have to involve alcohol, but it is nice to have a drink that involves some kind of mixing, to add another touch of ceremony. Put on some music, no phone, no computer, and slink into the evening. I find it a bit like a gentle evening meditation. Rituals and routines have been useful to me, and I am not alone. It's a simple act, but doing it the same way each day habitualizes it, makes it repeatable, easy to do. It reduces the chance that I skip it or do it differently. When you follow daily rituals, they impel you to get started. Whether it's the act of carrying a hot coffee mug to an outdoor porch, or the rock and roll that gets a painter revved up to splash colour on a canvas, or the stillness of a herb garden that puts a chef in a culinary trance, moving inside each of these routines gives you no choice but to do something. It's Pavlovian. Follow the routine, get a creative payoff. Twyla Tharp, The Creative Habit. Learn it and use it for life. Habits are rituals' responsible but slightly boring older sister. To live a successful life alone, you have to have discipline. Being disciplined doesn't come easily to me, but when you reinterpret it as simply acting out good habits repeatedly, it seems less daunting and more attainable. Keep yourself accountable. You are responsible for keeping your life on track. Accountable people don't give up. When they face bumps in the road, they find a way around them. Sometimes it's useful to have a reminder of how strong you are. I find wearing a piece of jewelry with my name on it helps me remember. It's hard to articulate, but since I have lived alone, my first name seems to have acquired a greater significance. It's all I have. It's me in a word, my calling card and my essence. It epitomizes my independence. I have a silver Jane dog tag and I wear it every day. Search name jewelry online. A good place to start is Etsy.com. You will know what suits you best, a necklace, bracelet, or a ring. You may want to add some other words or a saying that's important to you. If you don't want to buy more jewelry, think about having an existing ring engraved with your name. Be bold, be big. We weren't put on the planet to be small. Carve your own path and think big. Don't order from the set menu. Set your pitch to a higher frequency. Run a few volts through it. Put running spikes on it. Challenge yourself and be ambitious in your dreams. Some final takeaways. Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu said, "Contentment is the greatest treasure," meaning the way to find happiness is just to want what you already have. Sometimes I catch myself spending so much time planning an upcoming trip, the map, the walks, the menus of the restaurant, the opening times of the museums, and so on, that my day-to-day life takes a back seat. Carpe diem. We are responsible for changing society's perception of people who live alone. We need to be walking advertisements for our tribe. Every day is a new start. What you do today is what matters most. Enjoy your life living with yourself. I believe in you. You've got this. I'd love to hear how your path unfolds, so do reach out to me via theartoflivingalone.com.au. Invictus by William Ernest Henley. The word invictus is Latin for unconquerable. Henley's poem describes every person who has had struggles and come through them. William Ernest Henley was an Englishman who lost his bookseller father when he was just a teenager. At 12, he contracted tuberculosis and had one leg amputated below the knee. The other foot was saved through radical surgery. As he healed, he began to write poems, including Invictus. Its theme is the will to survive in the face of severe tests. The poem was recited by Nelson Mandela during his 27-year imprisonment. It gave him courage and strength to endure the time in his tiny cell. The first verse acknowledges despair that manifests itself as darkness. Henley isn't asking for help, but thanks, as an agnostic would, whatever gods there may be, for the immense strength already within himself. In the second verse, he is still standing tall, never complaining, despite the blows coming his way. He'd rather take a beating than give in. He is brave and looks his problems straight in the eye. The third verse indicates worse may lie in the years ahead, including death, literally or metaphorically. However, his inner strength has prepared him for this, and he is not afraid, not now or in the future. The final verse refers to Judgment Day, when our bad deeds will be added up and written on a scroll. Henley recognizes that even then he alone is responsible for his soul, his fate. His resilience and self-possession give him complete control over his destiny. Remember, you alone choose your path. Invictus. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Coda. Full disclosure. Life never goes according to plan. As I finish writing this book, my university-aged daughter is moving back in with me, and I no longer live alone. At least for the time being. Much as I love every hair on her out till four in the morning head, I realize how happy I was living alone. I taught myself how to do it well, and I miss it. Watch this space. Acknowledgements. Thanks to my agent, Fiona Inglis from Curtis Brown, who has always had confidence in this book. Also, a huge thanks to everyone at Murdoch Books for helping shepherd my words into the world, especially Corinne Roberts, Jane Price, Julie Mazur-Tribe, Madeleine Kane, Fleur Anson, Lou Playfair, and Carol Warwick. Also thanks to my children, Alex and Kate, and all the wonderful soloists I have met while researching this book. We are a special tribe.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.